How's it going?
It's good. Well, I have the remains of a cold
that
I picked up in Toronto when I was there last week. I think I probably got it on the plane, you know. So I was miserable early this week, but I'm feeling a bit better now. So.
Is it like congestion?
Well, it went through all the stages. It started with a sore throat, then it went to a hacking cough. And sneezing, and now it's sort of an occasional cough. So in the summer, it somehow seems, in the winter, one assumes that one has to do this, but in the summer, it feels like a real imposition, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I don't think I have allergies, but I had sort of tickle in my throat a little bit the last few days. I don't know what that is, but hopefully it doesn't
blossom
into some sort of yucky cold or anything. Yeah. Thanks for your summary of the images and stuff on the. I just looked at that before I signed into the Zoom. It was helpful.
I just needed, I think, because we're reading, going to read Lake Aloud, and I sort of felt we needed some kind of way to figure out what we're doing.
Yeah.
And so a kind of a short summary like that I thought would help. And I think the images are so evocative, too.
Yeah.
Hi, John.
Hey, John.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm getting my coffee. I'll be right back. I'm listening.
I'm not sure how many more we're going to get. Doug is not coming. Marco Morelli, maybe, but I wasn't sure. And I guess Michael comes, right? Does he? Can't remember.
I don't think Michael is.
No, okay.
Yeah. But isn't Doug usually comes?
He usually does, but he begged off yesterday. I think he said he needed a break from the internet. Which we all kind of do need from time to time.
Yeah.
Well, it's a little bit early. I have and yesterday's cafe was so intense.
It was intense.
Yeah, my brains were fried, which is a good sign. because, you know, when you're trying to put together so many different models and doing it in a group, in that 2-hour span, it was like taking a course, you know, in. And I felt that that's a very good sign, but it's intense.
It is intense.
It takes recovery. So yeah. The time that I had hoped to spend with this poem, I wasn't able to do the quality time with it that I wanted to. But I did some this morning, and I love it. I think this heaven and hell thing is just gorgeous.
Mm.
Hello, Marco. Glad to see you. So I'm looking forward, but I'm not a scholar of Blake. I'm just an incredible admirer of him. And he's moved me many times. I saw him, a collection of his art at the Metropolitan Museum. I think I mentioned this before. And it just absolutely stunned me.
It is amazing art. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to do the, I was just saying to Andrew, the little summary text I did with the images, because I think the images are so powerful. He may be one of the, because of course, what's interesting about his imagery is they're partly about the storytelling that he's doing. Unlike other artists who are usually telling an image in a, you know, a story in an image, but there's no connection to a text. Blake is the only one in these periods who was actually doing that. And even today, there aren't a ton of people doing that, you know.
John, when was that show in New York? Was that a while ago or is that recent?
Oh, no, it was about 20 years ago.
Okay.
It was at the Metropolitan Museum. And it was, I went back many times and I brought my friends because to me it was much more intense than drugs. But then I'm a little bit over the top anyway and a little bit vulnerable mm-hmm. to those kinds of things. But I could tell he had entered into the zone that I'm very, very familiar with. This is where angels and demons, they're all talking to you, sometimes in English, sometimes in Latin, sometimes in different languages. And they're, you know, and it can be, and horrific visions, and there can be enormous satire. And I think this is all in Blake and mm-hmm. in Heaven and Hell. I think an exquisite parody in many ways, Paradise Lost.
And did they have like the books like under glass or how did they actually?
Well, actually were some of his books, which his poems, of course, the these leafy images and branches and all kinds of you see figures emerging out of these forests and it's all weaved into the text in such an intricate way. Mm. So you see lines of text floating across and within these different images. So it's very entangled and entwinkled. I guess you could say entwinkled. I think that's the word. But the, I would like to hear you guys because I know you're much more scholarly about this, and I love what you've presented on the forum here, Jeffrey. I want to pay much attention to it, and also I just want to do a shout out to all of you for your poetry that you've been sharing. I think this is a very good trend, the interplay between reading these giants. You know, like Milton and Blake and Whitman and creating a communal effort, you know, sharing poetry, because I think this is going to be a lost art if people aren't going to sort of reconnect, I think, to the collective aspect of it. You know, I think so much poetry, so much of it I hear is just very solipsistic and, you know, just sort of, I don't know, but I love this. I love this juxtaposing Whitman and Blake and Milton. I don't know if this is intended by you, Jeffrey, but there's some resonances between these workers, these culture workers. And I think that prophetic voice is just absolutely necessary, you know? And again, can get bombastic and kind of absurd, and I can understand why people react against it. But anyway, that's my spiel. Thanks for this opportunity to reflect on this, because I hadn't read it in many, many years, decades ago, and it didn't mean much to me then, and it means a whole lot more to me now. So I think there is something about you just have to live with these poems for a while. So I'm really curious about other people's response. I'm going to go get my coffee. I'll be right back.
Marco, do you want to say a few words just to check in?
Well, that's why I was late myself. I had to hunt down some coffee. We're out of it in the house. I went downtown. First coffee shop was La Vita Bella, was closed. And I ended up finding another, going to the corner coffee shop, which is not as good. Actually, the coffee is delicious.
Is that the one I went to?
No, I don't think so. Unless it was, I won't say its name. I don't want to disparage anybody. But I am otherwise, I think, having a great day. It's a beautiful day here in Colorado. The sun is up, shining, the sky is blue, birds are singing. And I've spent the morning with Blake, and I spent some time over the weekend as well with his poetry. And I don't want to make a huge opening statement right now, because I think I need to get some sugar in my in me before really diving in. But I like Johnny, I have lived with Blake's poetry for a long time, but it hasn't like met the moment where it would mean a lot to me yet until now. And so I'm just like kind of in a swoon of pleasure, desire, joy, happiness with this, and the poetry is really a part of it. And reading Blake, it almost feels like a fellow soul, like a fellow traveler, like on similar paths. And so so it's a wonderful kind of recognition, I think, that I feel, and at the same time awe at this whole body of work, like all this here that I could spend, I feel, the rest of my life just relishing. So that's all I'll say for now.
Wow, I agree. I mean, in a way, I like Milton, but somehow the Blake is even more stronger. I don't know.
Well, I'll share a story. I have to get a book in order to share it. So, synchronicities and coincidences and like little messages. I've taken up the practice and the habit of when I go somewhere, if the mood strikes me, just to open up a book at random and look at the first page. Read what comes to me. And Ed Mahood has told stories of doing a similar thing. So, as you know, I'm married, and my wife, you may not know, is Christian. She's Lutheran. She goes to a Lutheran church in town. And if you had asked me in my 20s whether I would that would have been very low on my list in terms of what I would be looking for in a partner. And in fact, marriage itself would have been not kind of undesirable, you know, from the perspective of an earlier self. And through a series of events and changes in my views and attitudes, that changed. But I ended up marrying Kayla, and on Sunday she wanted to go to the church library and do some organizing, because she volunteered to organize the church library. It's a nice place. It's a very welcoming community. It's a nice space. And I don't like going there. Like, something in me rejects, rebels, is repulsed by, and repels the entire atmosphere of a church. And nonetheless, I'm married to a church-going person, and so I have to make peace with that. And so I went along. It was another gorgeous day like this, and I felt inspired, or I felt wanting to go with her and to go on a walk with her and the girls. And so that's what we did. And we walked down there, and I walked into the library, and it was of the church, and it was a very nice place. It was very serene. There was somebody sitting in the corner just reading. And I think church was in service, so everybody was in the other room. And there was a little display of books, all spiritual in nature, but not all like doctrinaire or Lutheran. And there was this book, Thomas Merton, who was a 20th century, he was a Trappist monk. He was also a poet. I don't know that much about him other than that he was a mystic, very respected by others, you know, other thinkers of the 20th century for his theology and for his story of faith. So I did this practice, and I opened up the book to this page where he's discussing the poems of William Blake. And I wanted to read what he wrote about Blake because although, you know, poking around through the rest of his account, there are attitudes or thoughts he expresses, which I would totally disagree with. I think that what he says about Blake here and Blake in relation to Blake's, to his contemporaries, other poets of similar age, the Romantics, is, I thought was very interesting. So I'll just share this. He writes, this is Thomas Merton. I remember with what indecision I went on into the spring, trying to settle the problem of a subject with finality. He's talking about his master's thesis, I think, that he was having to write. Yet the thing worked itself out quite suddenly, so suddenly that I do not remember what brought it about. One day I came running down out of the Carpenter Library and passed along the wire fences by the tennis courts in the sun, with my mind made up that there was only one possible man in the 18th century for me to work on, the one poet who had least to do with his age and was most in opposition to everything it stood for. I had just had in my hands the small, neatly printed Nonsuch Press edition of The Poems of William Blake, and I now knew what my thesis would probably be. It would take in his poems and some aspect of his religious ideas. In the Columbia bookstore, I brought the same edition of Blake on credit. I paid for it 2 years later. It had a blue cover, and I suppose it is now hidden somewhere in our monastery library, the part to which nobody has access. And that is all right. I think the ordinary Trappist would be only dangerously bewildered by the, quote, prophetic books. And those who still might be able to profit by Blake have a lot of other things to read that are still better. For my own part, I no longer need him. He has done his work for me, and he did it very thoroughly. I hope that I will see him in heaven. But oh, what a thing it was to live in contact with the genius and the holiness of William Blake that year, that summer, writing the thesis. I had some beginning of an appreciation of his greatness above the other men of his time in England. But from this distance, from the hill where I now stand, looking back, I can really appreciate his stature. To assimilate him to the men of the ending 18th century would be absurd. I will not do it. All those conceited and wordy and stuffy little characters. As for the other romantics, how feeble and hysterical their inspirations seem next to the tremendously genuine and spiritual fire of William Blake. Even Coleridge, in the rare moments when his imagination struck the pitch of true creativeness, was still only an artist, an imaginer, not a seer, a maker, but not a prophet. And maybe I'll stop there. But that rung a chord with me, I'll just say. And I feel the heat of that fire. Even if I'm not in it, I can feel the heat of it. And sometimes I'm in it.
Thank you. That was lovely. I read Merton. I haven't read all of his work, but I read some of it way back in my young adulthood. I was heavily involved in a protest movement, but it was based out against the Trident nuclear submarines in the American Northwest. And it was through a group that was called Pacific Life Community that included radical Catholics and Quakers, mostly, who had a kind of communal living arrangement opposed to all of the, you know, the capitalist hegemony and the nuclear weapons and, you know, the whole sort of mix of all of that. And Merton was one of the people that we read in relation to that. I wasn't either Catholic or Quaker, but I was a fellow traveler to this group. And took part in many of the activities and went to jail for a period of time over it as well. So, the interesting thing about Blake, well, I suppose there's lots of interesting things about Blake, and I'm not a scholar either. I'm just sort of, I have been working my way into his work for several months before. I think in a way I wanted to do this, this came about because of the Aurobindo reading of Savitri. And from the Aurobindo reading of Savitri, Savitri is clearly partly inspired by Milton's Paradise Lost. But once you get into Milton's Paradise Lost, you almost kind of led to Blake. Blake is a kind of shadow figure in relation to Milton's Paradise Lost. Shadow figure is maybe not the right term. He's partially illuminated and partly shadowed. That's just one of the characteristics of Blake, where he embraces both sides of the, just like Milton in another way. But he was such an odd man in his own time, right? He didn't fit in anywhere. He just did his things. And I had been reading Northrop Frye's book because I really felt that I needed some kind of mise en situation, some sort of way into Blake that would allow you to make sense of the complexities of this writer, right? Which is, and Frye's book turns out to be gold for this, because he had such an interesting, Frye is another writer that I dabbled in as a young man, but have come back to now, and I'm rediscovering Frye's writing. And his book on Blake is quite extraordinary. And one of the things he says is that you can't understand Blake just by looking at the texts. You have to dig into his mythology, the way his whole worldview. If you go into the worldview and then you go to the text, you can navigate the texts. But if you don't have that global worldview, it's very difficult to do. Andrew, you were writing a little bit about that in the forum, right? So you can kind of think about it as a Weltanschauung, the worldview in the, but I kind of like to think of it as a cosmology, because it is a cosmology. It's a sort of a story of the universe in the Blakesonian way, right? So I don't have a lot to say in introduction. I did put up the text on the web of my own notes, not complete, but just a kind of summary text, because I've been working through Blake. And so I actually have notes on some of his other writings as well. And that was the section that I had on the marriage of heaven and hell. Just to give me a way to sort of, because the poem itself is, it's not that long, but it's quite complex. It's got lots of pieces to it. And you sort of need some kind of frame for understanding the text, right? So I really don't want to talk very long, because I feel like your own ideas and thoughts about this are at least as important, if not more, than my own. So I also don't really know how to proceed. I thought we could read the text aloud, and I'm happy to start. But I would like to pass the job across to other people as we go. And I'm not sure we'll even get through the whole text in one setting. I suspect that we may need to stop far too often to actually get to the end of the text in one go. Although we could decide to read it all in one go and then discuss it after. So I don't know what you would like to do.
I just wanted to say, in lieu of the Merton reading, I had a really interesting experience reading Merton years ago. I don't think it was The Seven Story Mountain. I think it might have been another book that involved some form of memoir. And I didn't read the entire book, but I distinctly, I'll never forget this, I distinctly remember reading a passage that involved some area with a lot of trees and rain. And when I read that passage, I felt like he was transferring his state of consciousness through the book to me somehow when I was reading it. And it felt like there was this total intensification and like vivification, if that's a word, of consciousness. And I was like, oh my God, this is really intense. And then I didn't read the rest of the book, but it was really, I'll never forget that. It was really interesting. Yeah. I don't know what to make of his, I guess you could say Wordsworth wasn't a prophet. I mean, I guess that's relevant. But Wordsworth is still pretty amazing. Anyways.
I think Merton in this book, as I've been poking around, he's pretty opinionated in ways that are, I think, narrow-minded. I just wanted to say about Blake and the transfer of consciousness. I think that is my sense of who Blake is or what kind of a figure he is. And is, in a sense, he's a poet and that's his mode of expression, but he's more of a word magician, I think. And I mean that you could say a poet is a word magician, but not in the professional sense. Like this is very rough work in a certain way. Like there's a lot of errors grammatically, or not grammatically, but punctuation, things like that. I don't think he ever, my sense is, and this is me projecting perhaps a little bit, but he didn't see the role of poet in the same way that the other quote unquote poets of the age did, where they were cultivating that, that personas of that type, and then the skills and the forms and the polish that a poet would. Something different is breaking through, I think, in Blake. And part of what I think he's doing with this language is it's hard to say exactly how it works, but he's creating states of consciousness, like, or recreating states of consciousness that for himself, that then as readers, we can access, I think. I think that what you got from Merton and what Merton got from Blake is the same thing that, you know, that I'm getting from Blake, which is that just blazing awareness, like blazing aliveness, and the that blasts through kind of mental dualities, mental polarities, like heaven, hell, angel, devil, God, Satan. He's really, I mean, the satire comes through, I think, his using of language that is used in dualistic ways, in very subversive ways that explode those dualisms, like in a kind of radiance, a primordial blaze. And I think it would be wonderful to read the poetry. I don't think we'll get through that much of it. But I was curious, Jeffrey, because you said that you'd been writing a couple of papers on Blake, and I was wondering what those were about.
Can I make a suggestion? And if we read this whole poem, I'm all for that, but I don't think we should read it from beginning to end. I think we should break it up and maybe just find natural pauses so that we could, what's your response to this? And then we can be responding to the poem that we've just out loud in the space, and we could bring in whatever other scholars may be resonating with this, or something in history that this is evoking in you, or some reading of you've done in the Bible, because then I think it becomes something that we own rather than something that we've just pre-digested. Or I sit here and give a lecture, you give a lecture, you'll hear four lectures. And I think that would be we would be spoiling, I think, the benefits of coming together to do this. If we just could do, if we're going to do that, we might as well just stay home and read all day, you know? So that's what I'm just saying. Let's perform some of it. And then that's like good performers reflect upon what we just did. And maybe we could do it better next time. So that's my feeling. Also, I want to say one thing about Thomas Merton. You know how he died? An electric fan that was on fell into his bathtub. So I feel a relationship with him because something very similar happened to me. I was taking a bath, and I had very stupidly on a shelf a lamp right above the tub, which broke, and the lamp, which was on, fell right into the tub. I did something that I've never done before since. I was reclining like this in the tub, and my whole body went, and I was on the other side of the tub. But I could feel the current, the shock, evidently not enough watts to kill me or electrify me, but it gave me an experience I will never forget of this current, this live current going through the water. And I've always been a little phobic ever since then about like hurricanes and seeing people walking down the street knee deep in water. I want to say, you're so stupid. There could be a live wire right next to you. You fry it. But anyway, I'm just sharing that. Maybe something about the body electric that's being activated by this conversation. So thanks. Anyway, we could do it any way we want to, but I like the idea of musicians coming together and playing some of it together and then riffing upon it so that we don't, so that our left and our right, our intuitive and logical brains are unified. I think that would be my desired outcome.
Okay. It sort of aligns with my own way of thinking about the text. I didn't want to read it all through. I think we'll, a bit like with the Savitri or even the Milton, if you go too far, your eyes start to blur out and you're not sure what you're reading anymore. So I think what's the other thing I was going to say about because Marco, you were asking about so I don't, I haven't actually written anything. It's a project. And I'm doing a presentation on Blake, which I still don't know what the content is exactly, in September. It's a collaboration with another person here in town who's not an academic but has a doctorate in art history. And she's a specialist of this, I think I may have mentioned it before, of this Maurice Chabas, who is a painter. You can look him up. He was a mystic painter. And he was partly inspired by Blake, his own, you know, so there are echoes through. And so I proposed to Miriam that we do a joint piece on Blake and Chabas, or on the relationships between, or Blake as a kind of conduit for Chabas. And so this is what we're working on. But so most of my most of my papers these days aren't papers the way they used to be. So I used to write up a paper, I still do to some extent, you know, a classic paper where you lay out an argument and then you proceed through the argument and that's the paper. But these days, a lot of the papers that I write are, they are an argument, but my source material is my own fiction. And so it's a way of weaving in broader themes, you know, with my own writing that feeds them, which is a kind of an odd way of doing things. And so the Blake presentation will do something similar in the sense that what I'm looking at is the relation between image and text. And what I've been doing is developing a series of images that are Blake inspired. So they're like, they're Blake, they're not Blake, but they have resonances to Blake images and ideas. And I'm going to use those images to develop a text that weaves together Blake and my own writing in a presentation. But I'm not sure what it's going to look like. So. An adventure.
Well, that sounds like it has potential.
Yeah, so. So shall I get started? The Blake text kind of breaks up into natural pieces. I think even in the thing that I, in a way, almost that each image in the thing that I presented online, let me see if I can find it. Well, maybe just read the first bit, which is what's called the argument. And then we'll stop and proceed from there. So it's just two pages. So I'm not sure if we're all reading the same version. Or what I wanted to say, Marco, about the, yeah, he doesn't have, the punctuation isn't perfect and these kinds of things. But he was, unlike other poets of the day who were writing manuscripts and then turning them over to a publisher, he was publishing his own texts, and they were all hand calligraphied, right? So he was, in a way, it's all visual what he was doing, because it's all an image. Even the writing is an image, right? So it's very different from writing a manuscript and then turning the manuscript over to be published and read or printed and read, right? So I think that's part of why it's different in that way as well, right? So in fact, I probably should read off the original illustrated text rather than the printed text the way I'm doing, but I have notes in my printed text, so.
But it's important to keep in mind that there are different editions, and some editions attempt to correct the original. There's also notebooks, and like, as with, you know, any editorial project, variations and conflicts and so forth. So I have this complete edition that has the Harold Bloom notes in the back, and apparently it's the I don't know about more recent editions, but was the closest or the most comprehensive editorially. So I don't know how it compares to the illuminated manuscripts, though. I think those, I've looked at some of these, but I haven't studied them the way that you are. So I would be interested in hearing those versions and seeing them too at the same time.
I haven't actually compared the illuminated manuscripts to the, you know, because they, but I think they're direct copies, what I have here. It's something called the Complete Illuminated Books. And it has the, you know, I don't know if you can see it, but it has the illuminated text like that. The pages are like that. And then it has, you know, with my notes on it. Oops. Hang on. You know, printed text like that, but which is a direct transcription of the illuminated pages, right? With, I don't think, any editing or any substantial editing. So, So it might be different from the versions that you're reading.
Yeah, and on an iPad, it really is illuminated.
So, the marriage of heaven and hell. The argument. Rintra roars and shakes his fires in the burdened air. Hungry clouds swag on the deep, once meek in a perilous path. The just man kept his course along the vale of death. Roses are planted where thorns grow, and on the barren heath sing the honeybees. Then the perilous path was planted, and a river and a spring on every cliff and tomb, and on the bleached bones red clay brought forth, till the villain left the paths of ease to walk in perilous paths and drive the just man into barren climes. Now the sneaking serpent walks in mild humility, and the just man rages in the wilds where lions roam. Rintra roars and shakes his fires in the burdened air. Hungry clouds swag on the deep. Is that it? Or is there just...
That's that whole plate.
Yes, that's that whole plate, yeah. Yeah.
Could we, you guys mind if we read a little bit more before we start discussing?
Sure.
Do we want to pause or do we want to move on? Do we want to change the with another voice?
Do you want to go, John?
No, anyone want to do this? I mean, I will, but I just want to like keep some variety and also the rhythm. Take a break and say, let's work on this passage, or because a lot has already come up for me. I'm Rintra. Who is Rintra?
Yeah, well, I looked that up, but
I don't know if this is the time to pause, or maybe we should keep going, get more of the poem, the rhythm of it, and then you guys we can make a collective sort of nod to one another. A little overwhelmed.
I think we can maybe stop there, even that little piece, because the images don't, the text is this strong, ferocious thing, but the images are these light little figures dancing around on branches. And so already we've got a kind of contrast between the text, which is kind of a rage, angry text, and the images, which are giving a very different story, right? So that's already true. I feel a little bit caught in the mystery of this thing, right? And Rintra, I looked up, it's a character, according to Wikipedia and this kind of text, it's one of Blake's characters. It comes into several of his other poems, who is a kind of raging, rebellious spirit.
Yeah, Fry says that Rintra stands for wrath.
Right. And of course, because it's the first word, it's important. And so, and one text, I think, on the Wikipedia said it's a kind of an alter ego for Blake himself. So the anger is part of Blake's point of view here. Is a kind of, he's angry about the way spiritual issues are dealt with in the broader culture, and this is the first statement he makes, right, is about this, is a kind of place from this anger, so it sets a certain tone.
I like that. I do agree. It's the juxtaposition of the images and the weight of the rhythm. Rintra roars. I think it's and I know we've all read Blake and we've all read this poem, so we can. This isn't the first time I've read this, but it's sort of new things are coming up, and it seems to me obvious the songs of innocence and the songs of experience are weaved into this. Because I think the images, the paintings or the drawings they made sort of capture the innocence, and the text sort of grounds us in experience. And I think there's a kind of juxtaposition. And of course we know this is all subversive. He was living in a very repressed time. I don't know who was on the throne, but it was dangerous to say anything about anything. If you have your head, you know, you could be imprisoned. So I think, and we're right before the French Revolution, I believe, right after the American Revolution. So this was a time where you weren't supposed to speak up too much. And he was, look at what he's saying. He's very anti-monarchic. And he's anti-monarch. So I think, so that's what's coming up for me now, is this sort of what you, in response to what you were saying, Jeffrey, about the light and bubbly kind of imagery in strong contrast to this Rintra Roars kind of rhythm. So thanks. That's a great overture, I think, to what's going to happen.
Well, I do sort of feel, sorry, I want to let other people speak, but I'm kind of perplexed right away, right? I'm not quite sure, because I get the rage versus the, but you're left with an image that, a total image, if you like, where you're not really quite sure what to make of it or where even to sit within it, you know, as a kind of a, it's a kind of complete division of the visceral being reading the text.
Right,
that it is, so it sets up this tension right from the very beginning,
and it's ambiguous. It's,
yes,
misambiguity.
A couple of details I picked up about Blake's biography is that he lived into his older age, I think 70 or so, and at a certain point in his life and career, he had relationships with would-be patrons who wanted to sponsor his work, and he did engraving. He also could publish poetry, or that was the idea. Something didn't work out in those relationships where they wanted to mold or control him, and I think he just decided to leave, just to drop. And those types of those types of relationships, and go his own way. And I think, I mean, what I'm resonating here is the outsider who, you know, is walking perilous paths, but the paths that are perilous are combined with these images of growth and beauty, the river and the spring on every cliff and tomb is part of what I think the just man is. It's part of what is attractive to the just man, not once meek and in apparent, but now taking these perilous paths. And then there's this villain who comes and, in a way, usurps those paths and sends the just man into the wilds. It's from those wilds, from those that being on the being outside, and I'm struggling a little bit to understand, because I'm also puzzled by this poem. I think that there's a lot of complexity inside of the poem, but the place from where the poem is coming is a roar. Like Rintra roars and shakes his fires in the burdened air. Hungry clouds swag on the deep. I mean, that is awesome. I was walking to get my coffee, repeating that. I just wanted to have that one refrain in mind and let it sink in. Like that swag, hungry clouds swag. Never heard that used as a verb, and it's a great verb, because it brings together this drooping, or this sort of this downward settling down, drooping, but also this sense of, it could be swagger. There's a kind of a lurking menace, you know, to these clouds, and they're hungry. They're absorbing water. They're absorbing something from they're absorbing from the deep, the oceans. And it's like a thunderous, it's like a thunderstorm that is brewing. This is the landscape, I think, that Blake is invoking here. And yeah, I think that everything in between those two couplet, you know, those two lines, is a personal kind of story, I think. Just some thoughts on this.
It's also important, there's definitely some form of irony in the argument, which is probably obvious, but clearly there's this just man who is, if you read it that way, is like a form or a symbol for some form of regeneration and whatever. But then in a more cliched poem or platitudinous poem, it would end with a just man. And that would be our image of like righteousness or whatever. But in Blake, it doesn't end that way. And in fact, the just man winds up raging in the wilds where lions roam. And the sneaking serpent walks him out of humility. So there's a very apparent irony there. And the irony is sort of cosmic in a sense. And it's interesting because, I think someone said the word ambiguity, like there's no like Blake afterwards commenting on the meaning of this poem. He just gives us like Rincher roaring, the just man regenerating the world, then like the I don't know if the word is opposite of that happens, and then Rincher roars again. So what's Blake saying? I mean, is he saying that like the cosmos itself is like a mind fuck where whoever is righteous winds up being screwed over and the sneaking serpent is the one walking in malleability? Is that what he's saying? Or is he saying something else? I mean, is he just like having fun being subversive and like reversing dualisms, or is there something deeper going on? You know, like, I don't know. I think there's something deeper going on, personally, but I think it emerges, I think later, probably later in the book. I mean, because I guess you could argue that this is an image of like, what is it, where do you find meaning in a world such as the one Blake is giving to us? Where it's simply metamorphosing from the righteous to the serpent, or like what does one value in a world or a cosmos that, where according to Blake, like that's the sort of nature of the cosmos? It's an interesting question. I think
I think that's a very interesting question, and I think we're sort of fast forwarding into what's going to happen next. I think the voice of the devil is coming up, and I would love to read that, but if someone else wants to read it, that's great too. Or we could break it up. But I think there's something, I think the answers to a lot of these questions are laid out. I think there's a Gnostic voice here. And I don't think he has any clear answers for anybody about what our relationship should be. But I think in some ways, this is just coming to me. This is a kind of outsider poem, I think. And it's also, and he certainly was doing outsider art in some ways, which is probably why he wasn't a bestseller or got a lot of patrons picking up his art, even though now he's like, you know, he's hard to find. He's so popular. But I think that it's a meta poem. It's a poem about poems. I mean, we hear Swedenborg, we hear Jacob Bohm, we hear Milton, the Book of Job, the devil, and various angels. So I'm just playing out that this is sort of, a very Gnostic, but different kinds of Gnostic voices, I believe, are being explored in this text and maybe celebrated, but not without some trepidation, I think. I think it does go where angels fear to tread in this text, definitely. So, but shall we proceed, or do you? I still have
something that I need to finish up before we proceed. Because I really recommend that you read the illuminated version if you can get a hold of it, because it's easy enough to read the text straight through. And you always have the comment of the image. Because even as I listen to you say about all the content, I agree all the text is in there. But the image tells you something else. And if you've got the image in front of your face when you're looking at the page, you can't ignore the images. You know, whereas you read the text separate from the image, you can go, oh, okay, this text is saying this. But if you look at the image, it's not saying that. It's saying something else. The image is saying, yes, rage, yes, these different darknesses and conflict and tensions. Hey, but there's another story going on here. You know, there's collaboration going on here. There's greenness going on here. There's growth going on here. There's ecology going on here. The image, that's not what the text says at all. But the image, that's what the image says. But I really think it's important to keep the images in front center as you read, as one, and reading the illuminated text, of course, it's the way, you know, and I think also, you know, we're several of us are also involved in publishing ventures of one sort or another, and that and we all know the intense effort that goes into the publication process. You know, these are etchings that he had to prepare the metal plates. He had to etch in onto the metal plates the differences. He had to color, lay out the colors and then print them. You know, there's a complex process that went into making these things that is nowhere near as simple as typing into a typewriter or even writing by hand and then passing it. You know, there's a whole alchemical process going in behind these texts. And it's the other reason why I think it's so interesting. I mean, I was going to read the other text, but as we started working on this, I thought, no, you've got to read the illuminated text because that's the way it was meant to be read.
Is there something else about that something else that the pictures are providing? Because I hear a lot of energy that's coming through you when you talk about that something else. So maybe well, we can pause whenever you want. There. If you have the images in front of you, and pause. Please pause us.
Yeah, and yeah.
Reflect on that because I have not an illustrated version in front of me.
Well, the images are the ones I put on the forum, so you can look at them there if you need to.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and the other thing I want to say in terms of serendipity, so Marco, you talked about your serendipity. So it happens that I happen to be reading a book called The Just City by Joe Walton. It's a science fiction book. It was recommended to me by Mary Thaler, who we know. And Joe Walton is a science fiction writer in Montreal. So Canadian writers, kind of an interest there for us here to read. But The Just City is a very interesting book. It's about, it's the Greek gods Athena and Apollo who recreate a version of Plato's Republic, and they people it with different people from all of history. So they take Socrates is there, but they take Cicero and they take people from 21st and 22nd century, and they take, you know, and slaves from all different eras, and they all put them into the city with the idea of recreating Plato's Republic. And so the just city is this idea of a utopia kind of city. But there are problems with the city that emerge slowly over time. And it has an underside that's much less pretty than the intentions. And so this is the sort of the story of The Just City. And it's the first book of a trilogy. But of course, it has the same characteristics that we have on this page, right? So the just and then the infernal serpent, if you like. And anyway, it gives, reading this book gives me the same kind of tension I get from reading this page.
I think you've just convinced me though, Jeffrey, that I need to read this on my iPad because, or get the actual, a print, probably better, a print version of the text with the images, because I think that's how the transmission that comes through that is different than the one you get only from the words.
Yeah.
And that with the words only, I think it's too easy to turn Blake into a literary figure. I think I'm not saying he's a religious figure, because I think for him, religion comes after a more primordial force, which he calls poetic genius. And it's funny, as I'm imagining these original manuscripts that he's produced, I'm starting to feel like they would be religious kind of icon, you know, artifact of some kind. Like they would have some kind of energy, right? That gets diminished each time it's reproduced or abstracted or taken apart. But there would be something invested into the material object itself of those prints that Blake made, the engravings with the language, that would be actually like closer to the source of that of the language, closer to the prophetic or the visionary source of the language. So I think that's really interesting and kind of reorients my mind a little bit around this.
And Johnny, you were asking, what's the something else? Well, that's it. That is the something else. There's the energy that comes through the drawings in relation to, you know, even the words are on the page are not like printed words. They have like this word, the just man rages in the wild. The G in rages has these powerful curlicues. It's like the word rages on the page.
Yeah, there's
this in a very sort of intense,
it's almost like calligraphy, the writing. I've seen it in the flesh. In my flesh I have seen God, and seeing, being in the same room with the images and the text, the actual, you know, the originals, is an overwhelming experience. It cannot be captured by print in a book. Believe me, it doesn't come through at all. I've seen lots of Blake prints, and they made no impression on me like when I was in the physical room. The sheer physicality of the of the script and the images was really overwhelming. And I think what it reminds me of, I don't know if you know, in Baltimore, there's a, I think it's called the Wonder Museum. It's a museum of dedicated to outsider artists, people who are in insane asylums, you know, and, or who are very, who are outside of the art world entirely. But you look at the art in there, it's stunning. And it's stunning in the way that Blake is stunning. And I think there is an outsider quality to his work, which is very odd. And I think it comes because he was schizophrenic. I think we would classify him in that category. He saw angels in trees, and he got spanked for that. He walked down the street, and he would see images in the trees. And I think he had what's happening in between the culture, the social worlds that you share, and what was happening in his interior spaces. Were overlapping in ways that were irregular for other people. Not that there weren't lots of crazy people in his time. There certainly were. They were all over the place. And it was a lot of poverty going on, and we were just seeing the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution. And he looks at the waifs, he looks at the orphans, you know, he looks at the children. But I think the faces of woe, this is not a pleasant place, London. But I think there's something in this, in the next couple of sections that I hope we get to today. I hope we get to the next four sections because we're almost at after the hour. The Voice of the Devil, A Memorable Fancy. If we could just get to that, and I think we could unpack a lot more. Thanks. I didn't want to inhibit you, Andrew, if you have something to share.
No, it's fine. There's just two things I want to say. One is that, okay, so we're clearly all, and there's a consensus that we have to take into account the images and the text. Okay, so let's actually talk about the image. Like, we haven't really described the actual image and talk about, like, what is the relationship between what we are seeing in that image and the text? Because, like, we're kind of floating around that, but we're not actually looking at the image. So this is the image that I see. I don't know what image you guys are seeing.
Yes. It's
like there's someone on a higher branch of a tree,
yep.
And they are leaning down. It looks like it could be a female figure, maybe. That's how I see it. And the female figure is holding the hand of another female figure, which I interpret as female because she seems to have like sort of breasts without nipples. And the female figure on the lower branch of the tree has her hand up in the air. And the female on the upper branch of the tree is like, seems to be reaching down to the second female. Would you guys agree with that?
Yep. There's another set of images though as well.
Okay. What's the other set?
So on the lower figure is standing on the ground, not on a branch. But on the left of her, there are two or even three figures lying down. The figures on the tree are clothed. Figures lying down are naked.
Mm.
And there's one figure on the left who I think is maybe female. I think maybe they're all female. And then two figures on the right who look almost the same, but they're one behind the other.
Yeah, so I agree with everything you just said, Jeffrey. That's what I'm seeing too, although in my copy it's black and white.
Mm.
Okay, so let's see if we can, I mean, what are ways to interpret this? I mean, clearly I read the image of the female in the higher branch of the tree in the act of reaching down to the lower, the other female figure. To me, that seems to suggest some form of like aid or assistance,
yeah,
or help. There seems to be something happening where the lower female figure seems to want something from the higher female figure, and the higher female figure seems to be answering the lower female figure by extending her hand. Would you guys, I don't know, I mean, that's how I'm reading it. So there seems to be something about aid or assistance. And then in the other thing on to the left, which in my copy is harder to actually decipher, it seems like there's something going on related to like serenity, calm, relaxation.
Watching,
peace. And so that is interesting because if we're going to read these images as suggesting or evoking assistance and aid and serenity and peace, that is quite different, you know, emotionally or whatever, from this cosmic irony and wrath and arguably, you know, meaninglessness. So then how do you reconcile those two things? And I would argue that I wonder if Blake actually saw The Marriage of Heaven and Hell and maybe also his later works as having somewhat of a therapeutic value. Like, and I don't mean therapeutic sort of like, I don't know, like touchy-feely, whatever. But I mean it, like, I think Blake was interested in helping us to see things differently. And in order to see things differently, I think it's important to be able to think about things differently. So I wonder if this image of, like, the assistance is Blake's image for his understanding of what he's hoping to do, which kind of contrasts in an interesting, you know, frisson with the wrathfulness of the text. And then I'm open to hearing what you guys think. And then one more thing is that I totally disagree with the idea that Blake was schizophrenic. I'm sorry, unless you're using that word in a different way than is commonly used. I had a grandma with schizophrenia, and that was not what Blake was or did. And I think Blake was a visionary, but I'm honestly, when I read this first, I was like, Jesus, is Blake mad? I read this one passage and I was like, this is insane. But after, so I can understand that feeling or whatever, but after reading Fry, I'm quite convinced that Blake was not a mad person in any way, shape, or form. In fact, I think I think that reading of him is sort of like what he was, I don't know, it just seems like he's seeing everything totally wrong. That's, yeah.
Can we move on? I'd like to hear more of the text.
Yeah.
Okay. What I suggest, Johnny, if you want to read the next bit, but just read the one page up to evil is hell.
So why don't you read that?
Heaven has begun.
I want to read the voice of the devil. So why don't someone else do that?
Somebody else said read the next page.
What is the next page after the argument? What it comes after that?
It's as a hang on, let me.
As a new heaven is begun, and it is now 33 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you guys want to go ahead and read that?
Is that part of the argument, or is this something
else?
No,
it's a new part. It's the first part of the text.
Okay, so this is prose, right? Okay.
Yeah.
And then there's the voice of the devil, and then a memorable fancy, and I think then the Proverbs of Hell began.
Oh,
if we could just get to a memorable fancy, I think that would be.
I don't want to push this. I think we should read the first, each page and a piece, and look at each page. Because
I want to have a plan where we're going with this, because we can stop and pause and talk all day. I want to get something of the text, a chunk of it, so that I can absorb what the brilliant things everyone is saying here.
Why don't we read?
I'm getting lost really fast. I'm feeling a little schizophrenic right now.
Why don't we read As a New Heaven Has Begun and The Voice of the Devil, and then we could do a memorable fancy and then talk about that.
That would be great. Okay. That would satisfy all my requirements. And then we can talk the rest of the time. Can we do that?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll replay three.
Cool.
Okay.
And that'll go right into The Voice of the Devil. So you follow me, John.
Okay,
great. I won't stop. We won't chat. Okay?
And Andrew, could you do a memorable fancy?
Yeah, I'd love you. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
As a new heaven is begun, and it is now 33 years since its advent, the eternal hell revives. And lo, Swedenborg is the angel sitting at the tomb. His writings are the linen cloths folded up. Now is the dominion of Edom and the return of Adam into paradise. See Isaiah 34 and 35, chap. Without contraries, there is no progression. Attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate are necessary to human existence. From these contraries spring what the religious call good and evil. Good is the passive that obeys reason. Evil is the active springing from energy. Good is heaven, evil is hell.
The voice of the devil. All Bibles or sacred codes have been the causes of the following errors. One, that man has two real existing principles, a body and a soul. Two, that energy, called evil, is alone from the body, and that reason, called good, is alone from the soul. Three, that God will torment man in eternity for following his energy. But the following contraries to these are true. One, man has no body distinct from his soul, for that cold body is a portion of soul discerned by the five senses, the chief inlets of soul in this age. Two, energy is the only life and is from the body, and reason is the bound or outward circumference of energy. Three, energy is eternal delight. Those who restrain desire do so because theirs is weak enough to be restrained, and the restrainer or reason usurps its place and governs the unwilling. And being restrained, it by degrees becomes passive till it is only the shadow of desire. The history of this is written in Paradise Lost, and the governor or reason is called Messiah. And the original archangel or possessor of the command of the heavenly host is called the devil or Satan, and his children are called sin and death. But in the book of Job, Milton's Messiah is called Satan. For this history has been adopted by both parties. It indeed appeared to reason as if desire was cast out, but the devil's account is that the Messiah fell and formed a heaven of what he stole from the abyss. This is shown in the gospel, where he prays to the Father to send the comforter or desire, that reason may have ideas to build on, the Jehovah of the Bible being no other than he who dwells in flaming fire. Know that after Christ's death, he became Jehovah. But in Milton, the Father is destiny, the Son a ratio of the five senses, and the Holy Ghost vacuum. Note, the reason Milton wrote in fetters when he wrote of angels and God, and at liberty when of devils in hell, is because he was a true poet and of the devil's party without knowing it.
A memorable fancy. As I was walking among the fires of hell, delighted with the enjoyments of genius, which to angels look like torment and insanity, I collected some of their proverbs, thinking that as the sayings used in a nation mark its character, so the proverbs of hell show the nature of infernal wisdom better than any description of buildings or garments. When I came home, on the abyss of the five senses, where a flat-sided steep frowns over the present world, I saw a mighty devil folded in black clouds, hovering on the sides of the rock, with corroding fires. He wrote the following sentence, now perceived by the minds of men and read by them on earth. How do you know that every bird that cuts the airy way is an immense world of delight closed by your senses five?
I think we're going to be here from now till next year discussing these texts.
Well, it strikes me, this is a bit of literary criticism. He's going right into Milton in a very overt kind of way. And I think he's also drawing upon enormous amounts of occult literature here. And so, I think it's great. And I think the rhetoric is extremely inflammatory, intentionally so.
Yeah, I'm not sure that this is a poem. This is more like an assemblage of poetry, criticism, visionary reports, and philosophy and cosmology. I think that in The Voice of the Devil, you get a cosmology. And what I think is really interesting is it's really it's two principles. It's the principle of energy and the principle of order, reason, logos. He doesn't use that word exactly, but the same kind of Shiva, Shakti, the same kinds of principles that you find universally. And he's appropriating the language of Christianity in order to articulate his own cosmology here. So I think the connection with Aurobindo is really clear. Energy is eternal delight. I mean, that is Satchidananda. That is the delight that Aurobindo comes back to again and again as one of the primordial aspects of the cosmos, of being. So, one of the things I've been thinking as we're reading these poets is that they're not ordinary poets. Like Milton, Blake, Whitman, and there are others that I'm sure we could add to this list, but they fall into other categories. Like to them, the labels of seer, visionary, prophet, I think all apply, as well to Aurobindo. He's not only a poet, he's a sage, he's a seer, he's a visionary. And so I think that they're using poetry, but they're combining it with a number of other things in order to cohere, like what it is that they are, what their transcription of reality, essentially, is I think what it is. So I think it's brilliant because what he's doing is liberating energy from its demonization, like its cultural and historical and political demonization. And that is hugely subversive. And I think is part of what makes this work so alive and like vibrant even now.
Yeah, Emerson was really famous for saying that poets are liberating gods. Liberating gods. And I think you're right, Marco. I think that's a good way to read the poem. The only thing I would add is that also, like in the Voice of the Devil passage, it's interesting because he's talking about like errors in the first three numbers. And then he says, but the following contraries to these are true. So I really think there is a therapeutic aspect to his project because he's calling attention to errors, which are sort of like what he's arguing are errors in belief or errors in actual thinking, like how we think about things. But he's trying to offer like correctives to these ways of thinking. And for that reason, I do think it's sort of therapeutic in a sense. Yeah.
It's been bringing me back to my childhood because I grew up in a Catholic, going to Catholic church, and I never got too into it. I didn't become an altar boy or anything like that. And as soon as I could, I stopped going. But I'm going back and realizing that from a very young age, just because of my family and the culture I grew up in, I internalized deep notions of archetypes of what, of good and evil, Satan, the devil, and God. These are all very, 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 and obviously not just me, this is our whole civilization. And I think even if mentally we grow out of that and we become more sophisticated and educated and whatever else, I think that those archetypes still have this deep effect. And for me to go in and embody the voice of Satan, it was actually pretty, it was definitely therapeutic. I totally resonate with that because it's liberating energy. It's allowing me to be evil in a certain way. And to integrate that evil into a marriage, really, which for me is very literal. And so I think that that's a great point.
So I kind of want to look at the images, you know, surprise, surprise. So the image of the second plate, so the first part that we were just reading, as a new heaven is begun, which is kind of the argument, counter argument of the first page, which is sets things up. So this is, now we're talking about the two sides of things, right? The good side and the evil side, and paradise, and all of these progression and attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate. So these dualities, if we like. But the images are clearly darker than the first image that we were dealing with. So in a way, he's talking about, in the first page, he was talking about darker things and the image was light. Now in the second page, he's talking about these split ideas, but the images are darker. So there's a movement to a different energy space here in terms of the images. Now, there are two different images. The images on the top is, I guess, the energy of hell, if you like, maybe. And the image on the bottom has this hermaphrodite figure. So this image is somewhat more joyful, even the two figures running. You don't get the sense these are running in fear. They're kind of running in joy. So there's something else going on there. So these are, what I find about the images, they're full of very subtle things in a way that complements the subtleties in the text, but they say different things than the text, right? So...
I see at that bottom image, it looks like a phallus, an erection, and two children running away. This looks like a rape to me, an attempted rape, and the kids are getting away. Maybe I've been thinking about Epstein too much, but I think this is a horrific image. And I think the image up top looks very androgynous to me. I can't, it looks like a male female, could be a little of both in these flames, something that looks serpent-like. It's, I think, the serpent flame kind of image. It's mixed. I don't know. It just strikes me as bizarre. Nothing in this gives me any, I don't know. It just, I find it very disturbing. You know, I find it very non-cognitive too. It's very affective. I don't know what to make of it, but I think that's good. I don't necessarily have to make anything of it. It's just that the relationship with the text and the image and the juxtapositions, and does it conflict? Do the images contradict or do they complement? And I think they can do both, maybe at the same time. That's what's so tricky about this. And I'm really glad you're bringing in the visual side of this text, because I think it's very, very weird.
I agree. I mean, I have trouble with the visual. I have trouble integrating the pieces.
Yeah. Me too.
But I think in a way that's what Blake wants us to have trouble. You know. So. You know, and you may be right about the image at the bottom, but I look at the two figures that are running, and they don't look like they're running in fear. They're looking at each other as they're running. And there's a kind of, because their gestures are completely synchronous, there's a kind of complicity between the two figures that doesn't suggest fear. It suggests complicity. It suggests a...
But they're running away from the guy with the big dick. I think that's the important message here. And these were children. Children were sexually abused, and they were put in, you know, labor camps at a very early age, and they died very young. I mean, he writes over and over again in Songs of Innocence about these horrific scenes. Yeah, so that's what I'm getting.
Which is a good point, because, of course, we think of the Songs of Innocence as innocence, and the Songs of Experience. But that's not what Blake was doing at all in those images. The Songs of Innocence are filled with experience, and the Songs of Experience are filled with other images, including innocence. So they're not what they seem to be, what their state they
they're
are.
Very subversive, just as I think has mentioned earlier, how he takes the language of the Bible and subverts it. He takes the rhythms of King James and does something else with it. And I think that's very subversive.
Can I call attention to something interesting in the text that we read?
Please.
One of the things that I really like that Blake does, I don't know, it seems kind of more inadvertent, but I think it's hilarious, is in the passage that starts, "As a new heaven is begun," he just says, like, he goes, "Now is the dominion of Edom and the return of Adam into paradise." See Isaiah 36 and 35, which is like it's like a hyperlink. Like, he just drops it there. Like, he doesn't really explain it. He's just like, fuck it, I'm just gonna add this. Like, if you want to know what I mean, go to Isaiah. But like, I can't really think of any time I've ever read that in a book where someone does something like that, where they're just like it's kind of like, in a great way, it's like kind of lazy and like great.
That's right. Like,
you want to know what I mean? Go see Isaiah. Peace out. You know, like, he doesn't explain it. I love it. I love that. Yeah.
But of course, it's expensive to do any of these plates in time and effort. So it's kind of a shortcut that he's done, just rather than spell it all out, which would take up his space. Right. So
may I ask, what is Swedenborg? I've heard the name. I don't know much about him. Edom, and what do those mean to you?
This is This is Swedenborg's Apocalypse Revealed.
Wow.
He has several books this size. And he was a great Swedish scientist, mystic. And he was revered by many people and reviled by others, like Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant wrote a whole book debunking Swedenborg. It's a very unusual kind of diatribe. Obviously, Kant is very uncomfortable with the idea that there could be telepathic capacities where people could know the thing itself, which, of course, he says you can't. It's all a construct. And Swedenborg said, Swedenborg's experience, his direct experience of other realms. He gathered information, by the way, from other realms, and he delivered it to people who were in the living. One was a famous anecdote, and I think this would be helpful, because he does say some critical things about Swedenborg. But Swedenborg was, he was quite successful as a scientist. And it was only late in his career that he started to have these episodes, out-of-body experiences. They seem obvious to me that he's having out-of-body experiences. And he would report going to these cities or in other places, and he would look at heaven and hell, and he would have interviews with angels and with demons, you know. But he actually, she was a duchess or princess or someone in the royal family. She asked him, because she'd heard he was famous for these, having these kinds of experiences. And she shared some information about her brother who had passed on, who had died. And he had some information that he had died with, and he wasn't able to share, and had something to do with the inheritance or something. Anyway, he reported back to her, oh yeah, I made contact with your brother, and these are his instructions. And she was devastated, because these were the kind of things that no one knew except her and her brother. So these are the kind of things that, of course, gave Kant the creeps, that you could make these kind of contacts, and that there was an element of the objective, that the imaginal realms are not just fancy stuff that you're just making up, but that they have an element of the objective.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that Blake is wrestling with in this poem. And he has ambivalent feelings about Swedenborg, because I think it gets, Swedenborg was like goody two shoes and a little conventional in a way that obviously Blake is not. And he likes the demons more than the angels. So I think this is also I would like to ask a question about the question that he asks at the end of A Memorable Fancy. Sorry if there's a lot of background noise. They're doing a lot of construction. I'm living in hell right now. nothing but alarms and buzz saws and sledgehammers. But he says, how do you know, but every bird that cuts the airy way is an immense word of delight closed by your senses five. So I think this is another example. Is this a rhetorical question? Does he know the answer to this question? Or is it a real question? So I think that's where we could have some fun too. Because I think he knows what the answer to this is. And he's sort of not stating it in an explicit way. But I think it's sort of a memorable fancy. Anyway, just opening that up.
So just another thing about Swedenborg. I love seeing your copy, John. It was so cool. What's that book called? Swedenborg was a huge influence on the father of William James and Henry James. He was basically a Swedenborgian. And Emerson, I think, wrote an essay once about Swedenborg.
Helen Keller, also. Helen Keller was a Swedenborgian.
In terms of the word Edom, E-D-O-M, I don't know, my footnote says that it's from Isaiah, so Isaiah 34, I don't know. Yeah.
I should have just followed Blake's own instructions. He said to see Isaiah 34 and 35.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think we have to look that up maybe for next time. to go on with the images a little bit, the voice of the devil, so I don't know if you can see this, but it's surrounded in yellow light. So he's playing with us again. And interesting, the image at the bottom, which is the one that I put onto the webpage, kind of reinforces, I think, your argument, Johnny, about that image on the bottom of the other page. Because here again, we have a child being carried away by the figure on the left. Which
can you show it? Is it on screen share? Or is there...
Hang on. Can I do screen share?
Did someone just do that?
I had done that previously.
Where can I find the image? Is it in the...
It's on the forum, the one
Okay, I'll find it.
I'm going to pop it up. Do you see that?
Okay.
Which one? Is it the...
So the figure on the left, you can see their child is being carried.
Yeah.
Right? So that suggests, as you say, a kind of a... Some sort of...
He looks like he's rescuing the baby, or what? What's going on?
Maybe it's a rescue. But it's interesting because, as you say, there are images of children here embedded in the images in a way that's not discussed in the text at all. So it's like he's trying to tell us something else.
So it's maybe like a parallel world in a way. On occasion, not always, but the pictures just may have nothing to do with the text at all. Maybe just going off into another world.
I don't think they're unrelated. I think they're saying something else about what he's trying to say. They're like a medley in a song where you have a second voice coming in with a different, you know, I think of the obvious sort of Simon and Garfunkel's Parsley Sage Rosemary Thyme. This is a second song sung in interlines between the first one, which is about war, and the first one is about love. And so the two songs sung together have a very different statement than just the love song on its own, right? So this is that kind of a mix, I think.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
One thing I'd love to add is that I don't know if you guys experience this, but when I hear the text being read aloud or when I read it myself, there are certain words or concepts or ideas that I sort of have to move past because I don't quite understand them. And so there's an aspect of comprehension that isn't happening fully when I read Blake. But I would really urge you guys to read Fry's book. To read the book by Northrop Frye, because I think that it is possible through study to kind of, in some sense, master Blake's cosmology, and then those moments of incomprehension happen less. If it's something that you are interested in, because I know for myself, like, there are certain things that I seem to have somewhat understanding of, and there are other things I have no understanding of whatsoever, but I think if you really do study the literature on Blake, I mean, there's probably a likelihood that over time you can read this poem and really fully, in some sense, understand what he's thinking. So, yeah.
Yeah, he talks in the voice of the devil, that first line. All Bibles or sacred codes have been the causes of the following errors. In a way, I feel like there is a code. And it may be embedded and hidden, but for those who have ears to hear, let them hear, you know? So I think he may be writing in a way for different audiences at the same time. Else there's what's made explicit and what is implied. And yes, I think you can highlight this and bring it out and unpack it and then let it go back into the text and become invisible again. So I think that to me is the value of that kind of thing. Because I like ambiguity. And I think it's much more interesting to be with the ambiguous because it's beautiful. Right. And I also recognize, and I think there's some of this in the rhetoric here, that also there's that, there's some things you don't want to be ambiguous about at all. Right. You want to have like a contract that is understood by both parties and agreed upon. So I think he's playing with both of those kinds of uses of language.
Yeah, because like there's a passage here that I just found utterly opaque. I really have no clue what he's talking about. And I think that has happened, at least to me, very often when I try to read his epics, which I mean has been argued are like the sort of most important aspect of his work, like his book on Milton, or he has an unfinished work called The Four Zoas, which is supposed to be like absolutely amazing. But I mean, without, for me at least, if I don't read the critical literature on The Four Zoas, I don't really have an entryway into the text. Like when he says something like, "It indeed appeared to reason as if desire is cast out, but the devil's account is that the Messiah fell and formed the heaven of what he stole from the abyss." Like that really means something to Blake. And I would love to know what it means. I mean, like, but I actually don't know what that means. Like at a very basic level. But I'm sure if I read more Fry or whatever, I'd probably have a better grasp on like what that actually means. Like, what Blake was thinking when he said that, you know?
I think he also, I think that I'm sort of drawing upon Aurobindo. He wrote a book called The Future of Poetry. And I believe that Blake is in our past in some sense. And I also think he was back then drawing upon a future, which we are in right now. So, and I think he may be also drawing upon our future. Because the future hasn't arrived yet, and it never does. You know, we can only speculate, but there may be no present in which we can say, oh, that was in the past, and this is in the future. It's all such a blur. And I think he writes about that really well. But I can't help but skip forward. I know we've all read this poem, so I'm not giving anything away. The last line, "For everything that lives is holy." This seems to me coming right out of Allen Ginsberg. You know, of course, Allen Ginsberg riffed on Blake a lot, but I think if you look at Howell, you don't want to know where Howell's coming from. I think Howell's coming from Blake, and it's sort of direct and indirect ways. So I'm just throwing that out there too, because I think he's had such a huge influence on all of us, and this is what's sort of shaking me up by reading this. It's like, oh wow, now I understand where the '60s really came from. You know. I think he's just sort of recapitulating the '60s and perhaps our own time, recapitulating this sort of post-colonial impulse, an anti-capitalist impulse, and something different from this global liberalism. I think he was already fighting that fight before any of us were born.
Blake actually set, or Ginsberg set Blake's, some of his poems to music, Songs of Innocence, Songs of Experience. And if you go to the Pensum page, you can hear Ginsberg singing his compositions. And they're really funny and kind of quirky and, yeah.
First, how much time do we have?
Yeah,
how
long? I'm thinking we're coming up to the end when Andrew usually has to leave. And I'm thinking
we're going pretty soon. Yeah.
We need to think about what we're going to do next time. So do you want to keep going with Blake?
If you had a thought there, yeah. Want to finish that thought?
I do want to finish that thought. And for me to leave 20 or so minutes before the hour is nice because I have something at the top of the hour to transition to. But the what I read in this plate 5, which Andrew, you were referring to, and puzzled by the, I think has something to do with this Gnostic element, and in a way, he's writing a Gnostic gospel, and he's, and I think so is Ginsberg, and there's a way I think of seeing them as not being separate figures, but being part expressions of one voice in a way, one movement, so. I don't want to go too much further into that because of the lack of time, but Just to add my answer to the question of what to do next, I would love to spend more time with Blake, and I also know that I could spend a lot more time with Blake. And I think maybe it should be one or the other. Maybe we should spend one session with each of these figures and then do another spiral that goes deeper.
Something like that.
So I would love to move on to Whitman.
So we would do Whitman and then followed by Milton and then by Blake, and we could just
wrap
around.
That works for me too.
That's a great structure there. I think we're finding a structure here. That's great.
So if you could, Andrew, for Whitman, if you could give some suggested readings for next time to maybe talk about, does that make sense?
Yeah. Do you want me to do it now or should I wait?
No, put it up on the forum.
Okay, so just create a category or whatever? And
Well, what I'll do is I'll create a thing for the next, a page for the next session, and then you can put it in a reply to that or whatever, and I'll make it wiki, and then you can actually paste in the suggested readings.
Okay, cool.
Now, and also, I would make a request if we have the sections that we want to read, if we could make a desired outcome, we're going to read these sections. If we don't get there, that's fine with me, just so we have an intention, because it's really hard to just read the whole poem. You know, you have to break it down and chunks that are manageable each of our get-togethers. So I would make that humble request if we say, oh, we're going to read from this line to this line.
Sure.
Form it the way we want.
John, sorry if I came on too strong when I was talking about Blake and schizophrenia. I hope I wasn't being rude.
But no, not at all. And I apologize if I've been a little overheated, but I think that's what this poetry does to you. It heats I feel it. It heats me up. You know?
Yeah.
It's a very hot kind of text. And I think that the question that you raise is a very good one, because I think schizophrenia, what do we mean by schizophrenia? And I think that's a huge topic, and or madness for that matter.
Yeah.
What can madness mean when the ice cap is starting to melt? Because there's a heat dome over the ice cap, and it's 79 degrees was reported. 350 miles from the North Pole. This is disaster. And it's coming at us, my friends. So what would sanity be in these kind of conditions? And I think that's a really honest question. It's not a rhetorical one at all, because I don't have the answer to that. But yeah, I think that was very, very good response, and I appreciate it. I have to reflect on that.
I came across the word yesterday, hypersanity, as the sort of, that's all.
So we'll call it quits for today, shall we? I think we've done a good circle through the first part of Marriage in Heaven and Hell. I certainly learned quite a lot about the text that I didn't realize, which is what I rely on you guys to do, so.
The same with me. I thought I knew this pretty well, but now I'm learning from the free-for-all here and the different points of view that this is much more interesting than I thought it was, actually. So it helps to read together with other people who are really competent, as all of you are, and it really stimulates my thinking a great deal. So I'm going to take this out with me into the streets of Manhattan. I think it increases my resilience. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I'm going to leave here thinking about hypersanity as maybe an alternative reading of Blake and similar such souls. So looking forward to the next time.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.